Okay, Shalom Aleichem, everybody. So we really are at the beginning of our next step, which is we've been learning a little bit about the split of the kingdom, and now we've seen the political underpinnings of that split. Now we're going to look into the next step, which is once the split happens, how does that northern kingdom create itself? How does it create its identity? Is it a Jewish state? Is it not a Jewish state? You have two Jewish states. How does that work? How are they going to differentiate themselves as their own identity? And we see a rather tragic occurrence, because what we're going to be learning about today is how this doesn't seem to work. It doesn't seem to really work out. It doesn't pan out as well as it should have. So let's take a quick look. We're not going to do so many psukim tonight, but because they're so dense in theology, in trying to understand what's going on, we're going to spend a bit of time trying to really unpack them. So our movement tonight is going to be from psukim chaf hei to lamed gimel in the perek yud beis of sefer Melachim Aleph. Here's what we learn about. So as you remember, we've just now seen we've witnessed the splitting of the kingdom. We've witnessed that Yerovam has now taken control over the northern side of the kingdom, and we're waiting to see what he's going to do, and here is what he does. We're told, let's go through the psukim, then we'll consider some of the major aspects of them. Yerovam is Shechem, Bahar Ephraim. So the first thing he does is he really puts a lot of money into the infrastructure of Shechem, which is on the mountain of Ephraim. Vayeshev, he lives there. Vayetzim, and he left there. Vayiven es Penuel. So he builds two places, Shechem and Penuel. Vayomer Yerovam b'libo, and he says in his heart, Ato toshuva mamelacha lebeis David. I'm worried that the kingship, the reign, is going to return to the house of David. If the people will go down, or rather up, spiritually, to go and bring their sacrifices in Jerusalem, they're going to then return to their master, who is Yal Yerovam El Rechava Melech Yehuda, and they're going to now take his side, and they're going to return to the kings of Yehuda. So he's concerned that their religious leanings will lead to political leanings. Vayivoatz HaMelech, and he consults, he takes counsel. Vayas Shnei, and this pasuk over here is just one of the most strangest psukim in all of Tanakh. It really is astounding. Vayas Shnei Egle Zahav, he makes two golden calves. Vayomer Aleihem, and he calls over them, Rav Lochem Me'alos Yerushalayim, it's too much for you to go and ascend to Jerusalem. Hinei Elohecha Yisrael Asher He'elucha Me'eretz Yisrael. These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up from Egypt. Just astonishing. He places one in Beis El, and one he places in a city called Dan. And it becomes a sin. And the people go to worship them even to Dan. He makes priests who are not from the priestly tribe, from the tribe of Levi. He makes a festival in the 8th month. On the 15th, he makes a festival like it would be in Judah. And he sacrifices to these calves which he made. He establishes his priesthood on the shrine in Beis El. Vayal al hamizbeach asher asah beveis el. He walks up onto the altar in Beis El. B'chamish asah yom achodesh hashmini b'chodesh, in the eighth month on the 15th of the month, asher boda miliboy, which he invented from his heart. Vayas chag livnei Yisrael vayal al hamizbeach lakter, and he goes and he makes this sacrifice. I mean, it's so shocking. It's so perplexing. This whole thing. This is Yerovam ben Nevat, who just a chapter ago was indicated as being the potential leader for the nation of Israel. Achia Shiloni said you should be the king, and here he is. He's making, you know, it's shocking on all fronts. You know, because if you were to say, like, one of the top 10 lessons in the Torah is don't make golden calves, right? That's like, that should be up there. This is not like reading between the lines here, you know. And so it's just the whole thing is hard to come to terms with. Very, very strange. We're going to focus on three basic points just to try to unpack this. The first is something which should not be lost in the mix, and that is the first two cities that he establishes for himself. There's actually really, if you think about it, there are four crucial cities that have been discussed here. first of the two that he fortifies, that is Shechem and Penuel, and then the ones he creates as shrines, which are Dan and Beis El. Let's just take a quick look at the map, just to understand where and what we're talking about before we go further, and just appreciate this. So if you're to look at the map, let's just zoom in a little bit over here, on the map of Judah and Israel. So you'll see Yehuda is in the south. It's a pretty substantial amount of area in the south here. And then in the north, we have the larger kingdom over here, which is more of the tribes. This is the north and also goes eastwards. If you look in the over here, the very southmost point of the kingdom is Beis El. That's where Beis El is, almost on the meridian between Yehuda and Yisrael. And the very north is Dan. Is the tribe of Dan. It's in our area, which we would call the Golan Heights now, part of the way the source of the source spring is for the Kinneret. Okay, so in that area over there is where he put the two, which, if you think about it, actually does make a lot of sense, because he's essentially framing the kingdom by the north and the south territories by creating this. But what is also important over here is the other two cities. So where are these other two cities? So we see Shechem pretty much in the center over here, and Penuel actually is not marked on the map. Let me just see if I put it in the map at the end. I have another. This is another map over here. No, it does not have Penuel here either. Penuel is also pretty central territory in the we'll call it center heartland of Israel. So the question becomes: why these cities? What's so important about these? Why is he focusing on these four cities? And it helps us understand the mindset of what Yerovam is going through. So the first source that we look at is the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel says, very simple and very salient point. He says, "V'ein sofek." It would seem to me, he says in the first source, "Shechizek ha'arim ha'ele lefich shechashash ulai yitzarech lilachem im rechavam v'yu ha'arim ha'ele liyashev shama uliyisagev bohem mibnei Yehuda." So what is he doing? Why is he building up the cities of Penuel and Shechem? Because he is fortifying the southern border, because he is scared of an onslaught. Remember, just a moment ago, there had been conscription in the south. There had been an army of 180,000, which was amassed. And then Shmaya the prophet says to Rechavam, don't fight now. It's not a good idea, right? So he desists. But there's a real threat, says the Abarbanel, of being overrun. They're a new fledgling kingdom. He doesn't want to have to be worried about an attack from the south, so he establishes these. So this is purely a military move, says the Abarbanel, which is why the focus is these two southern cities. Shechem, somewhat southern. It seems also, by the way, from the Psukim, that it's not just that he's fortifying, it almost sounds like he's making his palace. This becomes, you know, the capital. Which is why, in a certain sense, he lured Rechavam there for the coronation ceremony in the first place to Shechem, the hotbed of his supporters. However, if you read the rest of Tanakh, it's not so clear that that is a tenable explanation. Because take a look, he has the parallel section in Divrei Hayamim. Okay, this is the parallel section that it is describing the same string of events, and after Rechavam desists from attacking the nations from the kingdom in the north, here is what the Psukim tell us. This is a section which is not in our Melachim Aleph, but it is in Divrei Hayamim Beis. So let's look at what Divrei Hayamim Beis adds into our story, and let's see how it unpacks or helps us understand this. Yeshev Rechavam Yerushalayim, in Divrei Hayamim Beis, Perek Yud Aleph, Yerushalayim returns he dwells in Jerusalem. Vayoven arim lamatzar b'yud, and he makes fortified cities. Vayoven es beis lechem ves etam ves tekoa. He builds up Bethlehem, etam, and tekoa. Ves beis tzur ves soicha ves adulam. He builds up Beth tzur, soicha, and adulam. Ves gas ves moresha ves zif. Those three cities. Ves adoraim ves lachish ves azeka. Ves tzorov ves ayalov ves chevrod ashev yudo binyamin arei mutzurois. Vayechazek es hametzurois. He strengthens the fortified cities, puts commanders over them, along with stores of food, oil, and wine. Whenever you put stores, you're worried about siege, right? He puts shields and spears in every city. And he establishes them, and he strengthens them greatly, and Binyamin and Yehuda were his. What kind of sense do you get from Rechavam at this point in time? Is he the victim or the aggressor, according to the way Divrei Hayamim is framing it?
The aggressor.
I don't know, Dina. I you know, when you start fortifying your cities, and you start putting stores into your cities, It sounds like what you're telling the people, and if I'd been a citizen at the time, it sounds like we're watching for an impending attack, right? So it sounds like
Or
he's.
you are getting ready for an attack.
Correct, you're getting ready for an attack. So
Or no, I mean you're getting ready to attack.
I don't know, when you bring the bombers over the enemy territory, that you're the one who's leading the cause. Here it's almost as if he's bracing for that attack, right? And what's interesting is the Psukim and Devarim do not talk about any fortification of the northern cities. Meaning, if you look at that string, that's a very significant string of cities that is labeled that Rehavam is fortifying in the south, but nothing. Silence about the north. So the Malbim says, with the greatest respect, Kavoida to the Abar Ben El, who he views as one of his teachers, he says, but it doesn't make sense. If you read the parallel narrative, it sounds like Rehavam is more in defense than would be Yeravam. Now, the Abar Ben El doesn't have to be fazed by these psukim. Why not? Could be both sides. It could be both sides are bracing for the attack, right? It could be that they're digging bunkers and sandbags on both sides of the border because they're worried. It isn't a contradiction. It just seems from the general temperature of the water, as we see in Devar Yamim, that there's more of a concern in the south than there is a concern in the north, which would mean, if that logic follows clearly, then the question would be, so now why Penuel and Shechem? So the question returns, if it's not a military consideration, what type of consideration is it? So the Malbim actually does offer us an alternative, but we have to be patient because the Malbim is not to be found here. The Malbim references himself in Sefer Hosea, and the reference actually, which he references, and I think somebody else must have put this reference in, is incorrect. It's not in Perek Beis. It's in Perek Vov. I was able to, sorry, Perek Yud Beis Pasuk Dalet. That's where the Malbim is. He has a very, very fascinating suggestion here. I'm going to not read the whole thing, but let's just take a quick look at one important point over here. It is so, so fascinating as to what's going on over here. He says, Lama Bachar, let me just try to find the exact area. Here we are. Lama Bachar es Beis El Dafka. Lama Bono es Shnei Harim Ha'ele, Shechem Penuel. Why did he choose Beis El? Why did he choose to establish Shechem and Penuel? Kol zeh Tavin b'mashe kosov ki aseres ha-shvatim yichsu atzmam al shem Yaakov v'hizdamu elav. The point over here is he is trying to associate himself and by extension his new nation as an extension of Yaakov Avinu. As he tries to find the holy shrines that would supplant Jerusalem, then Chishev es Darche Yaakov Avia Uma. He goes back and he looks upon the life and the journeys of the patriarch Yaakov. Shenevak ima malach Penuel. Where was Penuel? That's where Yaakov in a fort with the angel, the Saroi Shel Esav. Afterwards, in the morning, when he survives that encounter, he calls it Penuel. Mipenuel olach liir Shechem. The next journey was in the city of Shechem. Mishom Yishchem nasa lebeis el, v'shom bona mizbeach. Lochon bona es Shechem v'es Penuel, ba'asher ha'makomos ha'elu yesh bohem kedusha. These two places had holiness. Penuel mitzad ri'iyas ha'malach b'rishana. First, Penuel, because of seeing the angel. V'shchem sheshochan shom Yaakov, achar zeh bona sham mizbeach. Unbelievable. And why Beis El? He says, why is Beis El the place of the shrine and not just places that he built up? Because in Beis El, it was actually Hashem himself appearing, not just an angel. An amazing, amazing idea that the Malbim is sharing.
Just missing Dan.
Oh, yeah. So Dan is going to get to in a second. Why not? Why Dan in the north? But before we get there for a second, just to appreciate what's happening over here. In a certain sense, if you think about what the Malbim is essentially saying, Yeravam has to recreate national identity, right? Here, for years and years and years, the Torah has talked about Yerushalayim, 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 Aliyah LeRegel, and Lo Yasur Shevet MiYehuda, and the idea of this, we'll call it, you know, Davidic line of monarchy, and he has to break away from that. So in order to do that, he has to reverse to the point that David and Yehuda were no longer players. When's the first point before they were players is when you take one generation back from them, which is Yaakov Avinu. Because without contention, in all narratives, Yaakov Avinu was everybody's, right? in a certain sense, what he's trying to do, it's almost as if rewrite the history through Yaakov. Right, so let's forget what happened afterwards, and then it suddenly Lo Yasur Shevet Yehuda, that whole business about Judah being the firstborn and the king and so on. Let's take it to the place. So now everybody opens up their Chumash. Everybody, even the south, you talk about Yaakov, they all agree. Right? And now we have something to talk about. So what does he do? He finds the places where he can now find a national identity. He can say, now we have our own heritage, which is incontrovertible, and even they will agree with, which are going to be the places of Yaakov Avinu. And he builds up those shrines, which now lend themselves to this new identity he's creating. Now, Lahavdil, just to appreciate something, Lahavdil, and this is very, very different, but it's destructive later on in history as well. What Islam did was a similar kind of thing, not in a much more nefarious way, is they essentially argued that a lot of the Torah was corrupted, and the parts that weren't corrupted, the parts that corroborate their narrative, right? There was Abraham, and there was Yishmael. Then Yishmael became sort of the main platform for them. So they'll take the parts they like and the parts they don't like. Now, Yerovam was, perhaps, that's a lot to put into Yerovam's mouth at this point, but the idea, so to speak, of recharacterizing what is happening over here, recharacterizing the national identity, which is through these places and these shrines. But he goes one step further. The Malbim says something quite astonishing as well, even to take it further than where we were up till now. He says, if Alpizeh, he suggests, according to this, Omar Yeravam, Yeravam says, Kibe Beis El, Sham Nishar Hamalach Hazeh, V'Sham Yiskale El Navi HaEgel V'Avdov. He says, you know what? Yaakov Avinu, our patriarch, met an angel in Beis El, and that angel promised him strength. He says that angel still remains there, he says to his followers. And they're going to do the same as Yaakov did in the same place. What is that? Bahariv, Shieshlamim Achayhem Yehuda Kariv Yaakovim Esav. Wow! Just what an amazing thing. He's saying, in the same way that there was brotherly discord between Yaakov and Esav, and the place where Yaakov became triumphant over his sibling, Esav, who was the older brother who demanded the kingship, was in Beis El, well, the angel still remains there in our fight against that older brother, who also thinks he is so important, but really we know better. And that angel's going to help us. Do you understand what it's taking that narrative and now, so to speak, corrupting it or usurping it for the perspective of the new kingdom that of Israel that he's creating, says the Malbim. That's it's very, very powerful, deeply psychologically terrifying, and this is part of what he's trying to recreate over here. Wow. Okay. So
we need to assume.
Yes.
Everybody knows the history.
Yes, you know, Dina, I think, so I'm going to address that question in a moment, is how deep do they know history? But let's, at this point in time, you don't have Shas on your shelf, there's no Achronim, and there's no English, you know, art scrolls, sorry. All you have is the Bible, you know? So, like, at this point, you'd hope that people, so now what he's essentially doing is he's taking that knowledge, and he's saying, but, you know, a little bit of a twist. Right, and what we're gonna arrive at tonight, and this, to me, just I was talking about this at the supper table with the kids, is that a lie is far less dangerous than half a truth. A half a truth is a terrifying thing. When you start taking a little piece of something and you corrupt it in a different way, that's exactly what he did here, according to the Malbim. But let's take it further. Now we get to the major question. We dealt with the cities now, right? And Dina has a good point. We're still remaining Dan. By the way, what else was in Dan? Just to remember, what else was in Dan? Good. So you go back to Sefer Shoftim. There was already a shrine in Dan up north, and that was Pesel Micha, the shrine of Micha, and that's still there. According to Tanakh, at this point, it's very clear that it's still there, which means that he's already capitalizing on already another corruption in society, and he was, so to speak, introducing it into his system. Just that's also what's happening. That's also a very powerful thing. Later on, again, Lahavdil, Christianity did a similar thing. Christianity was a very weak religion at the beginning, and as it, so to speak, took over the known world, one of the things it did was it introduced the pagan ideas into its own culture, right? Saturnalia, a lot of these festivals introduced from the pagan world because it was very popular, and they sort of, you know, tweaked it a little bit into their own. Yerovam is taking Dan, he's taking the Pesel Mecha, which are still there, and he's sort of putting it into his own. Now, the major question the Mefarshim deal with is this, a very basic question, is What in the world? What in the world is he doing? What in the world is he doing? You know, I understand you want people not to go to Yerushalayim, but really? Like, this is the most brash, most brazen, most outlandish way. You don't think there's one, this is a majority of the nation of Israel, just one generation after the times of Shlomo. Nobody's going to stand up and say, hey, you know, I seem to remember that golden calves aren't a good thing. You don't think anybody's going to, like, just, you know, say something? You think the masses is so ignorant? Like, how is he even going to get away with this? Let's say what was his intent? It's so shocking. At least do something a little more subtle, right? I don't know. Make a golden shrine, but a golden calf? You know, it's just too shocking. So what's going on here? The Mefarshim really struggle with this. We'll take a look at three beautiful points that are raised by the Mefarshim. The one is the Ralbag Gersonides. He says a very, very interesting thing, and this is all of these are really thought-provoking ideas in terms of we live in a complex society where people believe a lot of things they hear, and you know this is worthwhile thinking about. He says, "Umira pela." He says, "This is really strange." Do you think people are so fickle? Do you think people are so, diverted from the truth that they would accept all these Isurim? They're sacrificing outside of the confines of the Mikdash, right? While there's an Isur Bamos, it's through people who are not priests, and it's to Eglei Zahav for crying out loud. So it's the Yidme, it would seem. Kilo osku Yisrael b'Torah, acho yu oichlim v'shoysim usmeichim kumoyshe kodam b'tchila samalchus Shlomo. He says, you know what? People will be merry, and they'll be partying. And when you're merry and you party, you sometimes forget the important parts in life. V'zeyo sibas niflom be'elo achatoim. And he said, that's why they fell. And he says, what's more? You say, wait a second. Are people that lowly? He says, Im shekfar ro bimei shlomo shenasu toi vois birushalayim mea toi vois agoyim. Well, they look back in Jerusalem. They say, you know, I seem to remember. They had a mizbeach to Kamosh over there, right? And that was Shlomo HaMelech's own wife who was building that. Right? So they look back and they say, you know, it can't be too bad. After all, Shlomo HaMelech himself had all these folks and all their shrines in Jerusalem at the end of his career. So the Ralbag says, the unbelievable is believable. But the equation he draws, by the way, is a very terrifying equation, personally. And that is, he says like this, they were living very comfortable lifestyles. And when you live very comfortable lifestyles, it's harder to remember the important parts. And that's not because, you know, it's a magical formula. I think it's just for a very simple reason. And that is that we have a bandwidth of interest in life, a bandwidth of things that we can be passionate about. And if we're passionate about the steak, it's very hard to be passionate about other things because there's only so much space of interest we have in our daily life. And we can decide where we put that interest and that passion and what we run to and what we don't run to. And what he's saying is that they're already entrenched in a very, very, you know, luxurious society. And so it's like, okay, the Torah, that stuff, it's not so, you know, we'll go with you, Yeravam, which is a terrifying statement, which means to say that so to speak, devolution in society was so fast and so overpowering and colossal that there was nobody stood up on their soapbox and protested. And he was so sure of that he was able to get away with it. That's the Ralbag says. That's all the Ralbag says. Now, that's pretty extreme. You have to admit, that's really extreme. That means to say that in such a short span of time, you can have such a reversal that nobody's going to protest against such a thing. Very, it's even so, it's very, very hard to understand. But nonetheless, obviously, there must be some truth in that because it happened. The Radak says, no, it cannot be. Rav David Kimchi says, this cannot be what's going on over here. He says in the next source, in source 7, he says, as we learn together, he says, Vayivo'atz HaMelech, the Melech consulted. Sha'al, it says, he asked, Eitzo Heyach Yaseh, what should he do? V'yiskim atosoy miyad, zimoy soy, and his counsel agreed to him, Shiyaseh shnei agolim, he should make two calves. Olama agolim, why calves? Posach oysam bidvarim. He started speaking to the people. Amalohim, he got into his, you know, it was his fireside chat that week, and he, you know, got onto the radio and he said, Amalohim, halo yadatem, ki amalchus nechlo kabarotzon akel. I, you know, folks, I have to tell you, the prophet spoke to me The prophet told me that we need to split up the kingdom. The prophet of God himself came to me and said, Yeravam, you're the man, you need to split away. It must be that God doesn't want the dynasty of David. And by extension, this is not what the prophet said, but by extension, it must mean he also isn't so keen on Jerusalem either. Because isn't that the seat of the kingdom of Yehuda? Im kain, so now that we've arrived at that logical conclusion, nase makom acher shetovo v'tizbuchu sham. So we should obviously find another place to sacrifice in. To whom, folks? To Hashem. V'lomo egel, why an egel? Amar lohem, halo Aaron asol Yisrael egel hashroi sashchina boy b'makom shemo Moshe shelo yosham gam gam. Who made the egel after all in the Torah? Was Aaron? Was Aaron punished? Was he struck down by lightning? No, he became the high priest. What was he trying to do? He was trying to bring Hashem close to the nation of Israel. Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't there. Gamatem ator she'ein lochem makom hashchina. We can't go to Jerusalem, Shirushalayim, because that's been rejected. Nase egel b'makom oyla hashros shchina boy. So we need a place. We need a place to serve Hashem. So let's use the egel in the same way they used it, because obviously Aaron realized it works. As they did in the Egel in the desert, he wasn't serving idol worship. Two is just a practical measure. You know, so it's a far distance. It was cliche. She wasn't in operation at the time. So you know, you just on the wagon, you know, with the donkey, it isn't so fast. So you put one in the north, one in the south. But who is serving? You're serving God. So the Radak disagrees inherently with the Ralbag. The Ralbag says, no, they were serving Avodah Zarah. How did they get there? Well, the devolution had already started happening. People already off the rails. They didn't protest. The Radak says, no, it was very smart. It's a half-truth, right? We do remember Yeravam. You're right. In the parashah, it did talk about Aaron making the egel. And Aaron wasn't punished. You know what? And that brought down the Shekhinah. You're right. We need a place to go. Obviously, Jerusalem's rejected. So let's find another place. So therefore, they started sacrificing there. You notice, by the way, that what do the psukim tell us about the end of this whole process? We see that in a few short psukim that they start establishing priests and they start serving. And it becomes a chet. Which means that even in the Radak's perspective, that perhaps the way he was able to convince the people, and perhaps the way he even really, if you were to ask him, you know, in the middle of your sleep, you'd wake Yeravam up in the middle of the night, and you say, Yeravam, what are you trying to do? He honestly would say, I'm serving God in our own place. He really believed he was serving God, but it doesn't work. It doesn't work, it ends up going bad. And that's what the Torah says, don't make molten images for a very simple reason. People like to have ritualized objects. And so you start coming to shul, and you're down into God, but there's a golden calf next to you. And then the next time it rains, you say, maybe next time I come to shul, I'll bring a little bit of hay to put by the calf, and maybe it'll rain twice. Right? You understand? That's what people are like. They need to have something. So therefore, it started off maybe altruistically, maybe well-founded, with a little bit of a corruption and an interpretation, but it ended up turning into Avodah Zarah. This, by the way, is one of the explanations. What the Kuzari says happens actually in the Chet HaEgel itself. It wasn't that they were trying to serve Avodah Zarah, they were trying to bring the Shekhinah in. So the same kind of thing. When you adopt creativity, which is against the word of the Torah, that's not good creativity. Creativity within the neutral ground where there's no, where so to speak, there's gray area, which is not forbidden, that may be fine. But when we talk about over here where you have creativity which runs in the face of what the Torah explicitly said, that is a problem, says the Radak. So a second explanation. This is a very divergent path to the Ralbag. Ralbag says, Avodah Zarah Mamish, and it happened, right? And look how fast people can devolve. The Radak says it wasn't. They accepted it because they knew their Torah. They weren't that such heathens. They weren't such backwards Philistines. They knew their Torah, but the half-truth that was spun to them, the logic which was spun to them was convincing enough that they got to this point, and it was a very profound political and religious move on the side of Yeravam. Let's take it one step further. The Arbar Benel says, still, it doesn't make sense. Doesn't make sense. Still, you know, I don't know, Zil Kori Beirav, they say in the Gemara, is just open up the psukim. Right? 3,000 people got killed. Right? In the end of the day, it wasn't good. They didn't get, it didn't work out. Right? So just open up Asher's Gezeiz or read a little bit more. And you know, the end of the story isn't good. So you don't give too much credit to the people. Says the Arbar Benel, no. We have to be a little more sophisticated than that. And here's what he says. Aval. In Source 8. By the way, it's a very, very long Abar Badel, as it is. I'm just quoting the very short, three short little excerpts. He says, Aval, haya inyonam, ki lefi shera yoravam, she shlomo oso shnei ha'amudim. Remember that in the building the Beis Hamikdash, Shlomo Melech made two pillars. Did anyone remember what their names were?
Yachin.
They were Yachin and Boaz. Okay, so on either side of the entrance of the temple, they had two beautiful, picturesque pillars. Vayosem osam Pesach ulam Beis Hashem. They're placed at the entrance of the temple. Lezecher Davidu Shlomo, Shabonu es Abayis. So according to this explanation that Barbanel says, they were actually a commemoration to David and Solomon in themselves, to the builders of the Beis Hamikdash. Kamoi Shepirashti, as he explains, because there are many interpretations of what Yachid and Boaz mean. Lachen Choshev Gamu, Lasso Zecher, V'Siman Lamalchusoy. He says, I need to also have some sort of, you know, tangible expression of my kingship. Ulevi Shehu Ayam Shevet Yosef Bimnei Ephraim, Rumoisha Olav Asholam Bibir Kosoy Asher Amar, Bilchor Sharoi Hodar Loi, V'Karnei Re'im Karnov. What was the blessing that Moshe Rabbeinu gave to the tribe of Yosef? He's the firstborn ox. Right, the strong ox. The beast of burden. Therefore, he says, "V'karni re'im karnov." Bohem amirin yelagach yachtov avsei aretz. Hem revoice the frame. Hem alpay menashe. B'yebachar yerovam lasos egel echad lezicharon mishpachtoy shush mishevet Yosef. Why the calf? It wasn't anything to do with the one in Kisisa. It was simply a national monument. What monument? Our mascot. Our symbol, who we are. Nothing to do with Avodah Zarah, nothing to do with shrine. It's simply the same as they did in the south, because they did it. Right? V'omnam, k'dei sh'lo yalu Yisrael Yerushalayim, osam izbech b'vesel. Now, he had to make an altar there, right? El asher, b'vesel asher ha'yusham kisei malchusoy, because after all, that's where he placed his kingship, b'mizbech echad b'dan, in one altar in Dan. There has to be service of God there. And they were serving God there. But when they come in, they would pay tribute to the king, king of Ephraim and Manasseh. And it could even be possible to say, well, it should have been one, but they did it because of the distances and the places. Why does he make two? Not just practical concerns in the north and the south, but because there were two tribes in Yosef. There was Ephraim and there was Manasseh. Why is he emphasizing that fact? No other tribe got two tribes that became their tribe. When do you see that somebody gets twice over a double portion? That's the clearest indicator of a Bechor, a firstborn. So what is he doing? He is saying, nationally, we're the Bechor. There's an Ephraim and there's an Asher. There's two calves. The symbol of our Malchus is the twin oxen. And therefore, that's why we deserve to serve Hashem in these places, which is demonstrating our allegiances to our Kodesh Baruch Hu under the new banner of the ox, as opposed to the banner of the lion, which is the Shevet Yehuda. This is very much, so to speak, the messaging which is trying to get out, and therefore has nothing to do with Avodah Zarah. That's what the Abar Benel suggests. Very creative, very beautiful perspective. And once again, the same kind of thing happens as it happens with the Radak. It's all well and good, and it's meaningful, but in the end of the day, a few years later, you know what happens. You know, when we used to go to visit Yale, in Yale, there's a statue in the freshman courtyard. I don't remember, one of the founding fathers of Yale, blessed memory. And so everybody puts their hand on his toe, you know, and the toe's very shiny in the copper because that's where people make their wishes and they can have a good year and the whole thing like that. Right, these are sophisticated Ivy League students, right? I'm saying the best and the brightest of the future. And they're still putting their hands on this fellow's toe. So, you know what I'm saying? Like, people like these things, which is why the Torah says, don't make these things. So, it still started off well, and it didn't end up so well. That's what seems to be happening over here, says the Abar Benel as well. Just a very powerful perspective as well. The Malbim has a lot to say on this. He presents both sides, and he gives a very good summary of this as well. The Malbim just adds one thing. We're not going to read it inside. But the Malbim does say a very interesting twist in terms of the archaeology of it. He says, where was Yerovam as a refugee? Where did he just come from? He was In Egypt. Well, if you want to read a little bit about Egyptian, you know, pantheons, it's interesting that in two cities, one called Memphis, not to be confused with what we call Memphis today, but Memphis and Heliopolis, there were those, in fact, were the twin cities which served one deity, which was the ox. And it's interesting, suggests the Malbim, maybe where Yerovam was staying was in that area. So in a certain sense, there was a corruption from the outside that he brought in back to Israel. Just interesting side perspective that sort of feeds in more into the Ralbag's perspective that it really is more real Avodah Zarah. Where from, suggests the Malbim in one of his explanations, the Malbim sort of does a survey of all the Mepharshim. He makes that very, very fascinating suggestion. Last thing, look, we looked at two points. We looked at the cities that he focuses on. We've looked at the, so to speak, the theology of this. Let's take a look at one last point. That one last point is this last month and this strange festival in the eighth month. What is going on over here? So it sounds like not only is he creating his own shrine, he's creating also his own system, right? His own system of celebration. The Chida suggests beautifully in his commentary, the Chomas Anach on Tanakh. He says, "Chag b'chodesh hashmini." He says, "Sha'oz kol ha'peiros ne'esofim b'bayis." He says, you know what? He made it based on the agricultural cycle. When are people most happy? It's kind of like, it sounds a little bit like, you know, Reform Judaism, right? Wouldn't it be more comfortable if everybody were to be praying in German, after all? It would make more people come to synagogue, wouldn't it? That sounds like a very reasonable suggestion. Wouldn't more people come if at the end of the harvest festival, you know, everybody could be in it and nobody's having to leave half the family at home to finish up the hay, the bales of hay in the field. You know, right? So to speak, you know, now that we're open to interpretation, we can do anything, right? So he creates his own calendar as well, says the Chida. There's another reason that is also interesting. This is the Yerushalmi Avodah Zarah. It says a fascinating thing. What year did he take? Did he ascend to the throne? It was on the end of the seventh year of Shemitah. What's special about the end of the seventh year of Shemitah? What is an event that occurs on Sukkot, on the last year, or following the last year of Shemitah? Does anybody remember?
Hakel.
Right. There's this thing where what happens is that all the community gets together, and everybody gets into the courtyard of the Beis Hamikdash, and what happens? Who leads the proceedings? The king. The king reads the Torah. Aha! Now that is a bit of an uncomfortable point. Because think about this right now. So from the perspective of Yerovam, he's now taking the reins at a time where, historically and biblically speaking, the king is going to send out an invitation for everybody to come. So what's going to happen? People are now going to get in their envelope, in their mailbox, two invitations, the red one and the blue one, right? They're going to get the blue one from the south, which says, in Jerusalem, in the courtyard where you've always been your whole life, you're going to hear from the king, Rechavam. And then they're going to get the red one saying, you know, in the outside, you know, pavilion tent that we just set up last week, where the lights aren't working yet, we're going to now have, and Yerovam also doing it. So he says, that's not going to work. I'm going to call them, they're not going to come. He's going to call them a second time, and then they're going to ignore me. It's embarrassing for me to even have to ask two times, because they're not going to respond. He says, "Ve'ech mikrin tzatinyan g'nai huli, ve'ech loy nikri bizoyon huli." So let's say I don't send an invitation. I don't send the red envelope. Then it's an embarrassment. Why are they going to him, not me? So now you understand what's happening? Well, what's going through Yerovam's mind over here? He has to recreate the calendar. He has to recreate the whole process because this is an impasse. There's only one. It's going to either embarrass him or triumph, and there's too much of a risk. And therefore, he shifts in this way. This is part of the machinations of, so to speak, recreating an identity. You see, when you have a goal in mind in life, don't let anything get in the way of it, right? You know, Migdash, God, everything else seems to fall away, unfortunately. This is what happens. That's how people go. There's one last suggestion that I would like to share this evening, and it's just also a really equally as astounding suggestion. This is in the Sefer Migdash Melech of Rav Yigal Ariel, who says the following suggestion.
Okay.
What does it mean? Hu asach chag b'chodesh hashmini. What does it mean he made a festival in the eighth month? It says, akavana, kanira. He says that the intent over here is what he suggests is Einenu l'chag chodesh mamash. It doesn't mean that he made a new festival. Elo le'ibur hashana. What was he doing? He added a month into the calendar. Ibur zeh shalai al das Yerushalayim. This was where Yerushalayim would never add an extra month. And it's not Adar. This is Cheshvan. It's right now. Hiziz es haluach shel malchus Yisrael ba'ofen kavua b'chodesh echod l'umas haluach shenahag b'yuda. He shifted the calendar that they would be celebrating in a stilted way the same festivals being celebrated in the south. Kach nishtana seder hashana bein hamalchuyot. Therefore, that he is now delineating, separating the festivals between the two kingdoms. V'am nechtzav ba'ofen amuk v'yosodi. And you've now split the people in a fundamental way. B'zois hisit yiravam es hadegesh hadgash mechalik ha-pesach. Asher tofas b'mokom chashu b'beis ha-midosh v'yehuda. V'etik es merkas es ha-koved l'chag ha-sukos sh'birushalayim nidchag l'shulayim. Thereby taking away the emphasis on Pesach, when everyone comes to the Beis Hamikdash to bring their Korban Pesach, to the focus being on Sukkos itself. He's now taking control of, now he's making people make a decision. And again, what you see comes out of here is a real fascinating thing. A lie is much less nefarious than half a truth. It's the same festivals. It's Sukkos and it's Pesach and it's Shavuos. It's Rosh Hashanah and it's Yom Kippur. But they're at the wrong time now. Everything shifts. Everything shifts. Where does this come from in the Pesukim, by the way? Where does the suggestion of the Mikdash Melech come from? Take a look at the Pesukim again. I don't know if any of you picked this up as we looked at this. He says, Vayal al mizbech asher osa beveisel b'chamish osa b'yam chodesh ha-shmini b'chodesh asher bada miliboy. In the month that he sucked out of his own heart, that he made up of his own heart. What does Rav Yigal Ariel suggest? In the month he made up, he introduced the new month. That's the month that we're talking about over here. Complete control over time, complete control over, so to speak, the decision-making of the nation of Israel. By the way, in a footnote, just to appreciate this, you remember a time later on in Tanakh, which we'll get to, God willing, soon, Chizkiyahu HaMelech wants to make a Pesach, Chag HaPesach, and there's this whole contention about between him and the Chachamim as to whether to be Ma'aber the year, to make one extra month that year to push the Pesach into 1 month later, right? And Chizkiyahu is criticized because of all of that. Says Rav Yigal Ariel, maybe that's what he was trying to do. What was Chizkiyahu HaMelech trying to do? He was trying to rectify the two calendars, the calendar introduced by Yerovam, which was always giving them a lag, and perhaps creating unity again. We're going to see numerous times there's going to be attempts to unify the north and the south, and perhaps this is one of those attempts as well. Fascinating perspective. Again, what Yerovam is dealing with is half-truths. Not falsehoods, half-truths. It's the same festivals, it's the same serving of God. It's a little bit of alteration, a little bit here, a little bit different there, in order to create the new perspective that he is. And it's very tragic because it happens really fast, and it takes the people in the street a very short amount of time to be following this new cycle, which shows you how terrifying leadership can be, which shows you how terrifying, so to speak, sheep mentality can be in society when you have somebody who's willing to twist the truth ever so slightly. And this is what happens with Yerovam over here. So this is, as you can see, this is just a lot to digest in one section. And unfortunately, this now pushes Israel in a very different direction to Yehuda. It's no longer two Jewish states in the same way. There's deviation enough to create quite a significant difference. Anyways, with this, we're going to close out.